We're back in our Shirim in Parsha Bereishit. This year and next year, Shirim 3 and 4 and Lech Lecha are going to also bridge to Vayera. We're going to be talking in depth about Abraham, Yitzchak, and Yishmael, the broader context in which they fit into, and since their stories flow over these two parshiot, so will our discussions, though. Today we're going to be rooted, certainly in the beginning, in our discussion in Lech Lecha, which is where we left off last time. So let's review. After 10 generations, we're going all the way back to Parshat Noach. After 10 generations of sifting through the sands of history, we finally find Avraham Avinu. Avraham Avinu is chosen, he's selected out from all of mankind to produce the Jewish nation, the 71st nation. He then goes to Eretz Canaan and brings along Lot, who we've defined as the genes of Malchut Yisrael, along with him. He plants the seeds for the process of Jewish history itself by overcoming the root exile of Mitzrayim and then defeating the four kings, the earliest manifestations of the Dalet Malchiot, the four stages of exile that we will go through over the course of Jewish history until we too reach the level of Malchut Yisrael at the end of days. Finally, he's promised that he will have children who will become the Jewish nation, and eventually those children will inherit Eretz Canaan, will inherit Eretz Yisrael, and that's the Brit that's formed at Brit Bein Abitarim. So coming out of Brit Bein Abitarim, the first five sections of Parsha Lecha that we outlined, we have two sections left. And what should happen next, now that Avram has been promised that he will have children despite his old age, and that those children will be the continuation of the Jewish people, the nation that he's going to start, and inherit Eretz Yisrael, what should happen next? He should have a child. And which child should he have? Yitzchak, because Yitzchak's going to be the child that is going to continue the Jewish people who will inherit the land. And yet what happens instead? What's the very next paragraph? The birth of Ishmael. Which makes no sense whatsoever. Why is Ishmael the next stage? Literally, the next pasuk is that Sarah is unable to have children, so she goes and she says to Abraham, take my shifcha mitzrit, take my Egyptian maidservant and marry her, and through her have a child, and I'll be built up through her. And in fact, she does get pregnant, and Sarah gets angry and throws her out. God sends Malachim. The Malachim say, don't worry, go back to Sarah. You'll have a child, and the child's name will be Ishmael. And so she goes back and has a child, and the child's name is Ishmael. So then what we should do is just find out, okay, who is this Ishmael? Why is he so important? I would have thought Yitzchak comes next, but okay, Ishmael comes next. But then the very next paragraph after that, we come right back to the same issues. You can take a look in your source sheets and source number one. I recognize looking in your Chumashim in Bereishit Perek Yud Zayin. Let's start in the middle of the discussion in Perek Tetvav. Vayomer Elokim al Avraham. God says to Abraham, Sarai ishtecha lo tikra et shema. Sarai, ki Sarah shema. Sarai's name is no longer going to be Sarai, but rather it's going to be Sarah. And somehow this name change is going to affect something within her to the extent that, uvirachti ota, veganatati mena lachabein. I'm going to give her bracha, and she's also going to have a son. Uvirachtiya vayital goyim malchei amim menu. She's going to have many nations who are going to come from her. Sarah's going to have a child. Vayipol Avraham al panav vayitzchak, and Avraham falls on his face and laughs. Vayomer b'livon, he says in his heart, halevein me'ash shana yivaleid, v'im sarah habat tishim shana teleid. How amazing is it that I'm 100 years old and I'm going to give birth to a son, and my wife is 90 years old and she's going to give birth to a son. How amazing is that? And he laughs. But then it dawns on him. He read the parsha too. And if God just promised that Sarah is going to have a child, what does that mean? That she's not a child, and that child is going to be the child to inherit and be the continuation of the Jewish people. Then what happens? Basically, Ishmael is being written out of history. You see that Abraham immediately understands that. The next pasuk, Vayomer Avraham el Elohim, Lu Yishmael Yichelefanecha. God says before Abraham says before God, that Ishmael live. He's not even sure he's going to be in place at all, because if everything is for a purpose. And Abraham is told, you're going to have a child, and that child will be the Jewish people. And then he has Ishmael, and as soon as he has Ishmael, God says, Sarah will have a child, and her child will be the Jewish people. Does Ishmael even have a place anymore? And look at God's response. God understands the question. God knows what Abraham is asking. Abraham's question is meaningful, and God responds. Vayomer Elohim, aval Sarah ishtecha yoledet lecha bein. Sarah, your wife, will give birth to a son, v'karata et shemo Yitzchak, and his name will be called Yitzchak. V'hakimoti et priti ito, and I will establish my covenant with him, with that son, with Yitzchak, lebrit olam azaruach harav, as an eternal covenant with his children after him. But in response to your request, says God, Uli Yishmael Shematicha, but I've heard you about Yishmael. Hine birachti oto, and I will also bless him. V'ifreiti oto, v'hirveiti oto, v'maod ma'od. That's already, when we see emphasized words like that, we're already learning a little bit about Yishmael, and we certainly see the ramifications of that with Bnei Yishmael to this day, that they're going to increase, v'maod ma'od. They will increase tremendously. Shnei masar nisim yolid unetativ l'goy gadol. So they'll still live, and they'll be a great nation, a numerous nation. But that briti akim et Yitzchak asher telid lecha Sarah lamoed atzeh b'shana acher. And all of this just strengthens our question. God says, I've walked you through all of Jewish history. You set the stage, and you are going to give birth to Jewish history. It's going to start from you, and you're going to have a child, and that child is going to inherit this land. What should have come next was Yitzchak. And if Yishmael comes next, it has to be for a reason. What's that reason? Kal v'chomer ben benosha kal v'chomer. If immediately right after Yishmael is born, the promise of Yitzchak comes right after that, to the point where even Avram is like, but let Yishmael live. So what's going on here? What's the purpose of Yishmael? What role does he play in this story? What role does he play in the story of history? Maaseh avot siman labanim. What is Yishmael all about? And why does it need to come before the birth of Yitzchak? Because we have to say the following. This is the only way to make meaning of the story. This is the only way to read what the Torah is trying to indicate to us. Which is that if the promise of Yitzchak only comes after the birth of Yishmael, then somehow the birth of Yishmael is a necessary prerequisite for producing Yitzchak. Somehow it must be that Yitzchak cannot be born until Avraham first produces Yishmael. We haven't added content yet, but then that explains the story. God says you're going to have a child who's going to continue the Jewish people, but there's something in the way. Somehow Yishmael paves the way for Yitzchak to be born. So then as soon as Yishmael is born, God says you're going to have a son through Sarah, whose name is Yitzchak, who will continue the Jewish people. But how could we say that? What does that mean? What does it mean that Yishmael is a necessary prerequisite in order to produce Yitzchak? We have to understand that. So in order to address these questions, we're going to introduce another essential, foundational concept in Judaism Bechlau, which is often referred to as the seven midot, or the seven sfirot. Okay, we're going to jump into the deep end today. Background. Everybody ready? We're going to go on a nice long journey, give ourselves some foundational concepts that will then build right into answering these questions directly. Starting really big picture. Chazal identify that there are four primary layers or levels of Torah. I think we've talked about this in our opening shiur. What are the four primary levels or layers of Torah? Shat, Drash, Remez, and Sod, or if you switch the middle two, you get the acronym Pardes from the first letters of each of the words. Somehow this grand orchard of Torah, the Pardes, which says in the Gemara that there was once Rabbi Akiva and his friends once went into the Pardes. It's a very tricky thing. One has to be very careful when entering into the deepest layers of Torah, because when he and his three friends went into Pardes, Rabbi Akiva was the only one who came out of Pardes healthy, normal, and alive. Not simple. We're talking about entering the deepest layers of Torah, all the way to the heart and soul of what Torah is about. So we have these four layers of Torah. First is Pshat. Pshat is often defined as the literal or surface meaning of the text, just understanding what's happening simply. I don't like the word the simple meaning of the text. There's nothing simple about Chumash, there's nothing simple about Torah. Who's the primary Pashtan? Who's the ultimate Pashtan? Rashi. What does Rashi spend half his time doing? Quoting Midrashim. Because there's nothing simple about the surface layer of the text. But Pshat is dealing with understanding the surface layer of the text. Drash is the exposition of the text by Chazal, primarily through Gemara and Midrashim, or the fancy term for it is the exegetical layer of the text. When we're talking about Drash, we're talking about the way that Chazal are learning out, based on their unique principles of Drash, what becomes Mamre Chazal, Midrash, and Gemarot. Sod is working on an entirely different level. What does Sod actually mean? What does the word Sod mean?
Secret.
It means a secret. It's somehow the more secretive or hidden layer of Torah. What is Sod often associated with? Kabbalah. Sod is often synonymous with the term Kabbalah. What does Kabbalah mean? Matala Kabel. To receive. Kabbalah means received tradition. It's connected to receiving. So what's the connection between Sod and Kabbalah? What did we say a Sod was? How do you get a secret? Someone tells it to you and you have to receive it from somebody else. That's the connection between the two terms. That's the only way that you can know a secret, is if you received it from somebody else. It's whispered from one person to another. You can't intuit a secret. You can't figure out a secret. The only way you can know a secret is if someone tells you the secret and you receive it from them. Kabbalah is the process of receiving the more secretive and hidden and deeper layers of Torah that are more private, more personal, more intimate. That's the way that they receive. That's Torah to Kabbalah. And that's how it's meant to be passed on in its proper context. What's Remez? I'm not fully clear. I'm not sure that I fully understand what Remez is. To my understanding, in my limited understanding, what Remez is that once we understand the Sod, once we know the secret, we can then go back to the text and we can see the way in which the text hinted to that Sod, hinted to that secret, once we already know the secret. Like, let's say, for example, you have a friend. She's a very nice person, you have a friend, and you didn't know something about her. And then somebody goes, and they tell you a secret about her that you didn't know before. Now when you see her, even though you knew her before, and you see her do certain things and act in certain ways, because you know the secret, you now see how what she's doing definitely reflects and hints to now what you know the secret is. You wouldn't have known it by simply interacting with her and watching her. But now that you know the secret, you can see how it's hinted to in her behaviors, in her actions, in her language, in who she is. That's in my understanding, my limited understanding, is the layer of Remez. It's important to understand that these four layers or levels of Torah are absolutely not independent of one another. They are dependent, interlinked. They're not independent from each other. They're not different, isolated components of Torah. These are four levels of Torah that are one text, layered on top of another. And every single one of these layers must emanate from the words of Torah Shebichtav. Pshat is the struggle to understand the words of Torah Shebichtav. Chazal are given exegetical tools by which to take apart and rebuild and mine the deeper meaning, al-pidrash, of Torah Shebichtav. The one that most often gets the short end of the stick is Sod. Sod becomes this thing that's out there. This out there Kabbalah stuff. That's not true Sod. Sod is not out there. It's in here. It's inside the text. It has to emanate from the text, which is what Remez is all about, which is linking back, seeing the hints to the Sod in the text. Yeah.
I didn't know that, but there's a very common misconception. Like, people with, like, Rosh will say something, they'll be like, oh, he knows it from Rosh HaKodesh. I'm like, no, he knows it because it's in the text. What is, like, the...
No, he may, through Rosh HaKodesh, have understood that that's the meaning of the text. there are many people, Bizman Hazeh, who definitely don't have Ruach HaKodesh, and who definitely should not be writing Sfarim, who are giving explanations of the words of the text that I think it's safe to say, there's certainly enough exactly that I'm right somewhere, I think I'm right in a lot of places, that what they're writing is not the meaning of the text, despite the fact that they're using the text. Rashi is correct, and Rashi is looking into Emet within the text, because he's somebody who was imbued with Ruach HaKodesh.
Okay?
But there are many schools of, quote-unquote, Pashtanim Bizman Hazeh, a conversation we can talk about, not within the context of the Shir, and certainly not on the recorder. There are certain schools of thought that I think they're absolutely unquestionably Kfira, because they are giving these beautiful, amazing, very well-attended Shirim about the Pshat of the text, that I think are incredibly problematic, exactly because of because of a related issue, which is, in my understanding, Pardes is linked. It's all one orchard. You can't isolate Pshat from Drash, Remez, and Sod. You can't isolate Drash from Sod. There's a phenomenon in this day and age to give a Kabbalah Shir, or to give a Gemara Shir, or to give a Pshat Shir. And when you do that, you therefore have the ability to only look at Pshat, or only look at Drash, or only look at Sod. And if you're looking at it in isolation, without the full scope of what Pardes has to offer, then you're literally missing the forest for the trees. And when you miss the forest of Torah, you're nowhere. Again, we can have a more nuanced conversation offline, but that's one of the areas where people are giving very powerful shirim that are very much based on the text, but in my mind are borderline fear. Because they're leaving behind 3/4 of Torah when they give over those shirim. I think that was vague enough that we can still put this in. Okay. Let's focus back in on what we're talking about. So, what we're going to do today is examine a paradigm that is a fundamental system in the thought of Sod and the thought of Kabbalah. One last preface, though. How are we even able to do that? Anybody heard the concept that you're not allowed to learn Kabbalah until you're 40? It's out there somewhere. We all heard it's out there somewhere. So how are we able to do that? So especially because this is one of the first times that we're overtly discussing Kabbalistic issues in these shirim, in Bereishit. So to set the stage for Torah as a whole, I just want to give a short preface about that here to share the perspective of my Rebbe. And he says that we live in a world where you have things like pop Kabbalah, right? Where we're all familiar with Kabbalistic concepts because they're being shared on the internet or through different institutions or in different places, where there's now a culture of pop Kabbalah, which in and of itself shows the incredible distortion that exists in our world on a level of Kabbalah. Maza pop? Popular for the masses. Kabbalah was never meant to be something which was discussed in a way that was for the masses. We just said that it's the most secretive, intimate, hidden parts of Torah. It's things that are meant to be passed from one person to another in small groups, given over the secretive, deeper, innermost layers of Torah. The Torah itself is something that's sanua. The Torah itself is a reality that's covered up, that shares itself very carefully, very specifically. We see that every time we take out a Sefer Torah on Shabbos, during the week, whenever we take out a Sefer Torah, we take it out of the Aron and we put it on the table. And we put it on the Shulchan. If any of you have been able to see from the women's section, in between Aliyot, to make a point that we take the cover of the Torah and we place it over the Torah, even between Aliyot, because we never leave the Torah exposed. And the distorted reality that we have today is that Torah Kabbalah, what people claim falsely as Torah Kabbalah, is everywhere. And where the people who most claim to be the bearers of Torah Kabbalah are the most anti-tsanua people in the world. And it's a tremendous problem. And if, lo aleinu, we are going to be exposed to realities of Kabbalah, or false realities of Kabbalah, because that's how it exists in the broken world that we live in, then even though I'm not 40 yet, so then you're not 40 yet, then what we need to do is we need to do the best we can to try to understand it in a proper context, in a context that's striving to understand the emet of Torah, the emet of Kabbalah, that's working based on a Mesorah of those people who are much older and who have deep-rooted Mesorahs from their Rabbeim, and that's the context that we are going to do our best to attempt to live up to in this form. Okay? With that sense of reverence and understanding, and the fact that we're trying to understand things that may be beyond us, let's try to at least scratch a little bit of the surface of one of these tremendously important paradigms. Ready to go? Let's do it. The paradigm that we're going to be learning about today is referred to as the seven sefirot, or the seven midot. The seven sefirot, which we're not going to translate, and we're actually not really going to use this term today, which are also known as the seven midot of a Kadosh Baruch Hu. What's a midah?
Character.
A character trait. So if we say that these are the seven midot of a Kadosh Baruch Hu, then what we're saying is that these are the seven character traits of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Labriyut. There's only one problem with saying that these are the seven character traits of a Kadosh Baruch Hu. It's total kfira. It is 100% unquestionable total kfira. And so that's why we need to pay very close attention, because we can either understand this the right way, which is great, and then we're on our way to understanding Torah, or we can understand it the wrong way, which is very bad, and then I have a lot to answer after 120. So, what are seven midot then, if they're not the midot of HaKadosh Baruch Hu? We're never ever talking about anything in terms of God Himself. We have no perception there. We can't understand God in essence. God is infinite. God has no borders, has no boundaries, has no limitations. God is infinite. He can't be limited by these midot, by these terms, by these character traits. Nor can He even be limited by our understanding. We are finite beings. How do I know that I'm a finite being? Here's my top. Here's my bottom, right? That's my head. Those are my feet. Here are my hands. I have specific borders and boundaries in the physical world. That's a reflection of the fact that I have borders and boundaries spiritually, emotionally, psychologically. We are all finite beings. We all have a creation point. We all have an end point. And it is literally impossible for the finite to contain or comprehend the infinite. We have no hasaga. We have no grasp. We have no understanding of God in essence. And again, either way, these can't be the seven midot or traits of God, because God can't have different traits. God is one. He is pure, undifferentiated oneness. Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. It doesn't mean that He's one. It means that He is the embodiment of oneness. God doesn't have parts. He doesn't have components. He doesn't have traits. There's no multiplicity within the context of God. God is pure oneness. So what then are these seven midot? How do we understand them? So listen carefully. These seven midot are midot that God created. They're seven created character traits. Seven created midot through which HaKadosh Baruch Hu interacts with and guides the world. God created these seven midot, and it is through these seven midot that HaKadosh Baruch Hu interacts with and guides the world. That's how we feel God's presence in this world. We can't, as we said, understand God's essence, but we can, should, and do feel God's presence. When we feel God's presence in the world, it's because He's utilizing one of these created midot and interacting with the world, interacting with me in this world through that midah, or through the other midah, or through that third midah. They're the way in which we experience God's presence, because it is through these midot that God interacts with and guides the world. We can't talk about God in essence, we can only talk about His relationship to us. We can experience God acting in the world and relating to us through these created midot. Questions, thoughts, comments on what these midot are? Now's the time. Choice between Torah and Kfirah. Any questions, now's the time. Good? One of the reasons why it's so important for us to learn about these midot and to understand these midot is because it's very practical for us. We're all created B'Tselem Elokim. And one of the layers of meaning of the fact that we're created B'Tselem Elokim is that we're created in the image of the structure of these midot. Hear this sentence. Just like God guides the world through these seven midot, so too are we expected to guide our own internal world by ruling over and harnessing and properly channeling these seven midot that exist within us. It's part of being B'Tselem Elokim, just like God guides His world through these created seven midot, so too are we meant to harness these seven midot which are inherent in us, understand what they are, come to a place of complete rulership over those midot, and guide our own internal world intentionally based on our ownership, our rulership over those seven midot that are inherent within us. Yeah. To my understanding, not. But when we start introducing them, see if what you're thinking of fits in. I suspect it will, and if not, we talk about it afterward.
Okay.
I suspect it has to. As we said before, all parts of Torah, including Sod, Pshat, Remez, Drash, and Sod, all parts of Torah need to emanate from
Torah.
Yes, and that translates to the text. Right, the Torah, the text. They must emanate from the text. As such, there's a pasuk which is viewed as the source of these seven midot, or seven sfirot. It's one of those great moments where you realize you've been saying this all the time and had absolutely no idea what it means. Not by you guys, unfortunately it's true for a large percentage of the Jewish people about most of tefillah. But let's try to at least crack this one pasuk a little bit, which we say all the time. We say it every day in Pesukei Dezimra, and every single time we take the Torah out of the Aron Kodesh. That pasuk is source number 2 on your sheets from Divrei Hayamim. Lecha Hashem, ha Yidua, Neha Gura, Va Tiferet, Va Neza, Va Hod. He called the Shamayim Uva Aretz. Hashem Amar Lacha. Bedula, Gvura, Tiferet, Netzach, Hod, Kol Vashamayim Uva Aretz, Malchut. These are the seven midot or sfirot. They're based on this pasuk. Alpi Kabbalah, they're given a very specific structure that we put up on the board. Gdula on the right, Gvura on the left, Tiferet in the center, Netzach on the lower right, Hod on the lower left, Kol Vashamayim Ba'aretz in the center, and then below that, Malchut. They're also, some of them are given slightly different terminology. Not in place of, but they're given slightly different terminology. Gedula over time becomes Chesed. And Kol Vashamayim Ba'aretz becomes Yisod. We're not going to get into Chesed and Gedula. How Kol Vashamayim Ba'aretz becomes Yisod we'll get into later on in Sefer Bereshit when it becomes relevant. But these are the terms they're given. Chesed, Gvura, Tiferet, Netzach, Hod, Yesod, and Malchut. Again, emanating from this pasuk, rooted in Torah Shebichtav. Now, it shouldn't be surprising that there are specifically seven midot or sfirot. We know seven is an essential number in the context of Torah. There are many examples of systems of seven in Torah and in Judaism. You can name some of them. What are some systems of seven that we have? Days of the week. Shemitah. There are 7 years in the Shemitah cycle and seven Shemitah cycles in the Yovel cycle. What else? Sukkot and Pesach are both 7 days. The 7 weeks of Sfirat HaOmer, good, yes. 7 weeks of Sfirat HaOmer. Zayin de Nechemta, which I strongly suspect are linking to these things, yes, but I've never seen the sources talk about it explicitly. And when it was brought up in a shir in 5764, I know it's on top of my head, 5764 with my Rebbe, he also said he suspects it as well, and he doesn't know, and he hasn't seen a source either yet, but hopefully in the last 15 years he's seen a source, and I'd love to ask him about that, to cling to the Zayin de Nechemta. It's a conversation for another time, but from Devarim issues. Keep going, what else? And the Yushbizin are also seven. So many systems of seven, because seven is such a fundamental number. But I want to jump on Hannah's example, which is the seven individuals who just visited us in the Sukkah. Who are the seven Ushpizin? Avram, Yitzchak, Yaakov, Moshe, Aaron, Yosef, and David. Excellent. Each one of these individuals is deeply associated and connected to one of these midot. This is how it's overlaid. Chesed, step two. Avraham. See, now we're suddenly slowly getting back to issues of Lechcha and Vayera. Avraham. Vura is Yitzchak. Tiferet is Yaakov. Netzach is good. Moshe. Hod. Aaron. Yisod, Yosef, and that's why I said we're going to get back to Yisod later on in Sefer Bereishit. We discussed the individual of Yosef, and Malchut, the primary king of all time, is David. What does it mean that each one of these seven individuals is deeply connected to one of these midot? What does it mean that Avraham is linked to the midah of Chesed? What does that mean? It means that Avraham is Chesed. I can't say it's stronger than that. It means that Avraham is Chesed. Avraham is the one who brings out the Midah of Chesed into the world in its fullest form. He's mitakened, he fixes it in reality. Every single detail in the life of Avraham that we're reading in Lech Lecha, that we're reading in Vayera, that we're reading in Chayisara, every single detail in the life of Avraham is the unfolding and bringing out of the Midah of Chesed in the world in its full form. Avraham and the Midah of Chesed are one. Each one of these individuals and their Midot are one. When Avraham's life is completed, the Midah of Chesed is fully completed. Avraham becomes the carrier, the Merkava, the chariot of that Midah, the Midah of Chesed. And anytime a Jew acts with Chesed, he or she is activating his or her Avraham Avinu side. That's embedded within us. And this is true of all seven of these individuals with regards to each one of the seven midot. If we're claiming that Avraham and the Midah of Chesed are one, then to properly understand Avraham Avinu, we have to understand what the Midah of Chesed is all about. So what is Chesed? What does Chesed actually mean? How do we define Chesed? So how do we normally, in conversation, when it comes up, how do we normally translate labriyutz? How do we normally translate chesed? What are words that we use that are thrown around when defining chesed? Loving kindness. That's, I think, the most famous one. It must be an art school, right? Loving kindness.
I've also heard it in lectures from other religions. They'll be like, express loving kindness a lot.
Oh, loving kindness. It's so beautiful. Loving kindness. That's great. I want loving kindness. Giving, altruism, benevolence, those are already bigger words from previous generations. We'll stick with loving kindness. It's two of our favorite words, right? Chesed is loving kindness. So that's great until you actually read Psukim. Then it becomes a problem. Let's take a look at source number 3, for example. I challenge you to find a way to fit the words loving kindness into this pasuk. Source number 3 comes from Parshat Kedoshim, which re-emphasizes the arayot that are aser. V'ish asher yikach et achoto bat aviv bat imo. One who lo aleinu, if a man takes his sister and has an aser relationship with his sister, v'ra'at ervata, v'hitir et ervato, chesed hu. It's a chesed. And they receive karet, and they bear the burden of their sin, and they're killed. Not how I would have defined it, loving kindness. This, to me, doesn't fit the definition of loving kindness. I'm not going to ask if anybody disagrees. We all disagree. That is not an act of loving kindness. But it is, says the Torah, and this is important, it is an act of chesed. What that means is that our definition of loving kindness and even altruism, benevolence, all of these words are woefully inadequate. They're lacking. They don't get to the broadness of what the midah of chesed is all about. So how do we properly define chesed? We have to understand that nothing in this world is good or bad. Things are neutral. They can be utilized in positive ways, and they can be utilized in negative ways. But they're neutral in nature. And if that's the case, how can we better define chesed? What's a broader, more neutral, and therefore more accurate definition of the word chesed? What is chesed? Any of you who have been in our shirim in previous years hopefully should know this definition off the top of your head. How do we define chesed? Excellent. Chesed is the tendency of anything to go beyond its boundaries. Full stop. Chesed is the tendency of anything to go beyond its boundaries. Any action I take where I go beyond my boundaries is an act of chesed. The act of going beyond my boundaries is inherently neutral. It can be expressed in positive ways, and it can be expressed in negative ways. In that way, chesed is a tool. It's something I can utilize. I can use it to build, and lo aleinu, I can use it to destroy. But it's entirely up to how I use it. There are many positive expressions of chesed. Acts of loving kindness are positive expressions of chesed. Helping an older woman across the street with a heavy bag is an act of chesed. Bringing somebody chicken soup when they're sick is an act of chesed. Those are positive expressions of me going beyond my limits, going beyond my boundaries for another person in a positive way. But because chesed is neutral, it can also be expressed in negative ways. The case of the pasuk that we just read is a perfect example. If one goes beyond his or her boundaries to connect with someone who it's usur to connect to someone who's one of the arayos, it's a negative act of chesed. I'm going beyond my boundaries in a way that is totally 100% asur. It's chesed, but it's destructive, distorted, poisonous chesed. It's still chesed, but it's a very negative expression of chesed. What would then be other examples of negative chesed? What are other obvious ways that I can go beyond my boundaries in ways that are problematic and destructive and asur? I wouldn't necessarily say so. Think simply. When Ru of Tzikaniyot, they don't know. Lashon hara. I'll tell you, because I'm not a perfect person like the rest of you, if I go and steal something. I'm going beyond my limits, my boundaries, my space into your space, and I'm taking something of yours. That's a negative act of chesed. Trespassing. If I go onto your property when I'm not welcome on your property, I'm going beyond my limitations, my borders, my boundaries. That's a negative expression of chesed.
Does it only have to involve another person?
Say more. To my understanding, not. It could be, and I'm just not familiar with it. In the sense that God says that avodah zarah is a form of znut, with regards to being focused on him or breaching that relationship and going beyond that relationship to other gods, small g, then maybe yes. I've never seen that used as an example, but it definitely fits.
Right, because all the examples that you're saying is between people, or between...
So I guess if it's a breach between man and God, or illegitimate lower g gods, then potentially yes. But certainly, arayos, theft, trespassing... those are all destructive, distorted expressions of chesed. That's not good enough. We've got to go a little bit deeper. What makes these distorted expressions of chesed? All of these above, all of these are obviously negative things, but what makes them negative expressions of chesed? What's wrong in these cases? For sure. To give it just more refined terms, the problem is that in all of these cases, these are all extreme and unbalanced expressions of chesed. And that's a concept we're going to keep coming back to today and on Wednesday in these two shiurim. That negative chesed is extreme and unbalanced chesed. Chesed is an important midah, and we're meant to constantly be acting with chesed. We're meant to give. We're meant to do acts of loving kindness. We're meant to go beyond our boundaries in positive ways. But there must be limits. Without those limits, I can move into extreme and unbalanced expressions of chesed, lo aleinu, like theft, like trespassing, like arayot. That's what opens that door. That's what creates the potential for negative expressions of chesed. Once we have this definition, there are a lot of areas of Torah that fall into place. One of my favorite examples, and relevant for us because we covered this story, but we skipped over this aspect of the story because we didn't have the terms to understand this part of the story. It seems like everything we're doing constantly goes back to Parshat Noach. So let's go back to Noach again. What did the generation of Noah do that was wrong that caused them to be destroyed? Well, that's the word that's used in the Chumash that's actually difficult to translate. What did they do? Arayah. What else did they do? Theft. Avodah Zarah, which is why I kind of like that it possibly is linked in. But the two that are certainly emphasized constantly, you can go to two drashot on Parshat Noah. And one person will say that the reason for the mabul was an unprecedented relationship with Arayot. A complete loss of an understanding of what a relationship is meant to be. And so you'll say, well, no, the Gemara says, what was it that sealed the fate of that generation? Gezel, theft. And you walk out of those two drashot thinking to yourself, I have no idea what Torah is talking about. Because I just went to two drashot and they said totally opposite things. The point is that there's a deeper root. What does that tell us about the generation? What does that tell us about the Dor HaMabul? That the issue with Dor HaMabul was that it was a complete distortion of a reality of chesed. There was a total breakdown on a level of chesed that expressed itself in arayot, that expressed itself in theft. Keeping ourselves focused? Possibly. Keeping ourselves focused? So based on our discussion, we can see that there's a deeper root. At its core, there was a complete breakdown in the level of chesed. All chesed became negative, extreme and unbalanced chesed. Now watch this. What was God's response? What was God's response to the Dor HaMabul? It's in the name. Destroyed them how? Dafka destroyed them with a flood. How is the mubble an appropriate response, midah keneged midah, to the breakdown of chesed? That generation distorted chesed by expressing extreme and unbalanced chesed in negative ways. Hashem similarly expressed giving and chesed in the form of rain and water. But just like Dora Mabul, it was an extreme and unbalanced bestowal of rain and water and chesed. It was so extreme and so unbalanced that it had nowhere to go, and it flooded the world. Midah keneged midah. They had a breakdown of chesed, and midah keneged midah, Kadosh Baruch Hu destroyed the world with a breakdown of chesed itself. And in its wake, what happens is there's a reestablishment of boundaries, of limits. Mankind will only live a certain number of years. We're going to limit the lifespan. There are going to be limited finite seasons. Like I think we mentioned even in those shirim, that the siman, that there's the brief, that there's not going to be another flood as a rainbow. And there are many mefarshim that discuss the fact that what HaKadosh Baruch Hu did is that while we originally had the capacity to, from 160 degrees, destroy the world on a level of chesed, HaKadosh Baruch Hu cut that in half, limited our capacity, and the rainbow, the half circle, shows our new limited capacity post the Mabul. Because God established limits and boundaries. He balanced out that chesed. Which brings us to our final piece here before we can plug everything in. How then does one keep chesed properly in check? What is the mechanism or the midah that balances out chesed? Which midah is that? Gevura. Which stands opposite of chesed in the structure, the midah of Gevura. The midah of Gevura is the midah that is opposite chesed and that gives it balance in the same way that the midah of chesed will give balance to the midah of Gevura. Based on what we said so far, how would we define the midah of Gevura? If it's the balance of chesed, how would we define the midah of Gevura? We often define it simply as strength. A gibor is somebody who's strong. But it's much more than that. What is the broader and more accurate definition of the term Gevura based on what we've discussed so far? It's the tendency of anything to hold back or, using our words, remain within our boundaries. You're 100% right. To hold back and remain within our boundaries. It's a midah that maintains borders, that holds back, that looks inward, not outward. That's the midah of Gevura. That's a deeper meaning of the well-known Mishnah in Pirkei Avot. Next source on your sheet, Ezu Gibor HaKovesh et Yitzro. Now, I would have thought a gibor is the strongest person in the room. The person with the biggest muscles, the person that can lift the most weights, that's the gibor, that's the strongest person in the room. The Maharal there beautifully says that it's not possible. He says, if you look at the animal kingdom, a gibor in the animal kingdom is the strongest animal. If we say that the midah of Gevura relates to human beings as well, human beings are more elevated than animals, and what that means is that Gevura must have its own unique definition and relationship to something that's uniquely human. What's uniquely human in the midah of Gevura? It's not external strength, but internal strength. A gibor is one who is kovesh et yitzro, their bechirach of sheet, one who overcomes their yitzir, one who was able to restrain themselves and overcome their negative inclinations and hold them inside, create borders, create boundaries, one who has the self-control to remain within his or her boundaries. Chesed and Gevura are on opposite sides of the structure of the midot and the sfirot because they're meant to work with each other to create balance and to prevent the extreme expression of either midah. We're expected to act with both chesed and Gevura and to do so with balance. One last thing to overlay, and then we will actually bring this back to the individuals in our story. Is that the structure of the sirot is also overlaid with the human body. Anybody familiar with how? Chesed is keneged, is linked to specifically the right hand. Traditional hand. The right hand. Gevura is the left hand, Tiferet is the torso, the trunk of the body. We talk about that a lot when we get to the parshas of Yaakov. Amazing things there. Netzach is the right leg. Hod is the left leg. Yisod is the reproductive area of the body. And Malchut, which gets a little trickier, according to many, is, without getting into it, is not directly correlated to a part of the body, but is rather the kli, the vessel that holds all of the other midot, and we'll be talking about that a lot more later as well.
So what would that be
like? I don't know what that word means, so I'm not going to say yes or no, but it's the kli, the vessel that holds all of the other midot. That's all I'm going to say for now.
Okay.
We'll talk more about David HaMelech as we go along. Tov. So again, Gvura is related, Chesed is related to the right hand, and Gvura is related to the left hand. We're meant to use both, and they're meant to balance each other out. And we actually, again, once we know that, we can then explain a Ma'amar Chazal, which almost literally says this. Once we know these paradigms, so many areas of Torah start to light up. Look at this Ma'amar Chazal in source number 5. Tanu Rabbanan, Le'olam Tehei Smol Dochak V'yamin Mikarevet. Forever should your left hand be pushing things away, or in our words, maintaining boundaries. V'yamin, what is your right hand doing? Mikarevet, reaching beyond my boundaries and pulling toward myself. But the phrase itself, first of all, reflects this very structure, smol dochak, v'yamin mikarevet, and also once again emphasizes the fact that both are necessary and need to be used in tandem to create proper balance. This is one layer of meaning of the pasuk, source number 6. Kiet gamet ze l'umat ze asah elokim. That God creates everything with balance. Everything in the world has its counterpart that gives it balance. Chesed and Gvura are meant to balance each other out. Questions on the midot, specifically on Chesed or on Gvura? Anyone? Good? So let's now come back to our parsha. Ready? Here we go. We started off today with a question. Why do we need Ishmael? We have Avraham. We have Avraham's chesed. Great. We have Avraham. Avraham is going to give birth to the 71st nation, to give birth to the Jewish people. He should have gone on as soon as he was promised that and gone on and had Yitzchak. Why do we need Ishmael? So let's go back to the beginning of our narrative of Sefer Bereishit. Which we went over at the beginning of Shir for a reason. Watch what happens. It took us 10 generations of sifting through the sands of humanity, of human history, until we finally found that pearl in the sand, like the Medrash told us, that pearl that was lost in the sand. We finally found Avraham Avinu. All external factors had been selected away until we finally find Avraham. And once we find Avraham, we should be able to begin Jewish history. But it seems that the process is not yet complete. How is it not yet complete? So what we have to say is, and we're going to have to back this up, we're about to make a wild claim. What we have to say is that while the pearl has indeed been found, and that, yes, all external elements have been selected away and removed from the system, it seems that there are still elements within that pearl itself, within the system, that need to be extracted and removed from the system. It took 10 generations to find the pearl, remove everything externally, but now it seems we need to extract things from within the pearl itself, from within the system itself. Avraham is the one who is selected from all of humanity. But it seems that there are still elements within Avraham Avinu himself that need to be selected away and removed from the system before he can begin to produce the Jewish people. Now, he spent this whole shiur establishing that Avraham Avinu is the complete embodiment of Chesed. He and the Midah of Chesed are one. What that means is, what that has to mean is, if Abraham is the complete embodiment of the Midah of Chesed, that means that he contains within him the potential, not actualization, that Avinu contains within him the potential for both the positive and the negative expressions of the Midah of Chesed. Again, Avram may only express the positive elements and the positive aspects of Chesed, but as the embodiment of the Midah of Chesed, he contains within him the potential of the negatives of Chesed as well. Does that make sense? Is that clear? If he is Chesed, he's got to embody the positive and the negative. He only expresses the positive, but if he is that Midah, he must contain within him the potential for the positive and for the negative. Before Avram Avinu can continue the road to producing the Jewish people, he has to purify himself by removing the negative aspects of Chesed from within himself. What we've defined as the extreme, the unbalanced aspects of Chesed. How does he do this? We'll prove this next year. How does he do this? Somehow, by having a relationship with Hagar HaMitzrit, he's able to draw out the negative and extreme elements of Chesed from within himself in the form of Yishmael. Somehow Yishmael is going to be the embodiment of negative, extreme, and distorted Chesed. We said Yishmael is a necessary prerequisite to Yitzchak, because it's only once these negative elements of Chesed are removed from Avraham in the form of Yishmael that he's able to produce Yitzchak. As long as the negative potential exists within Avraham, it's destined to come out later on in his descendants, and they will inevitably manifest those negative aspects of Chesed. Only once the negative potential has been removed from the system in the form of Yishmael can Yitzchak be born. Last point. We're done. What we'll have to then do on Wednesday, we have a big challenge in front of us. What we have to examine on Wednesday is how Yishmael is the embodiment of distorted and unbalanced Chesed through Pesukim, through Chazal, through Midrashim, through Gemarot. And we have to understand why Yishmael has to come through Hagar specifically. And then perhaps most importantly, not just understanding who Yishmael is, why he's this way, and why he has to come about through Hagar HaMitzrit, on a level of Ma'aseh Avot Siman Lebanim, we have to understand what the implications of this are for the rest of the entirety of history. So next year we'll exclusively focus on the individual that is Yishmael, both in our Parsha Lech Lecha and in Vayera. Understand who he is internally, what it means that Avram related to Hagar HaMitzrit, and again, the implications for all of history when we understand on a Ma'aseh Avot, on a Levanim level, who Yishmael is. Hope to see you on Wednesday, Bezrat Hashem.